Good afternoon. You're listening to Motherlands, an Asian Heritage Month special programming show on CITR 101.9 FM, brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host, Isa. CITR 101.9 FM broadcasts from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. I hope you've all been well. Today's episode of Motherlands is called Conversations, so it's all about exchanging ideas and intergenerational dialogue. First off, we have a conversation between Shaili Chaudhry and her father about their shared love of a Bengali poet. Then I speak with UBC professor Ben Chung about an exciting new Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies course. Lastly, we have a piece by Joshua Azizi about his father's childhood in Iran and the story of how his parents met. All right, let's get started. Shaili Chaudhry is a recent graduate of Communications and Gender Studies from Simon Fraser University. Shaili is currently working at the YMCA doing community support for single mothers in Vancouver. She is passionate about South Asian arts and culture. This piece you're about to hear is a conversation between Shaili and her father about Rabindranath Tagore. He was a poet, musician, and artist, an important figure in Bengali culture still celebrated today, as well as the first non-European to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. Let's take a listen.
On the 7th of August, 1941, in the city of Calcutta, a man died. His mortal remains perished, but he left behind him a heritage which no fire could consume. It is a heritage of words and music and poetry, of ideas and of ideals. And it has the power to move us, to inspire us, today and in the days to come. We, who owe him so much, salute his memory.
Thank you so much for tuning into CITR 101.9 for Asian Heritage Month. I'm Shaili Chaudhry, and I'm here to talk to you about a household name in Bangladesh, Rabindranath Tagore. Tagore was in my house growing up everywhere you went, in conversation, in our music, our dances, on our walls. A literary genius from the small but formidable country of Bangladesh, Rabindranath Tagore is remembered as the father of the Bengali language. Born in 1861, Tagore was born the youngest of 14 into a house that was already extremely artistically inclined. He went on to become a poet, artist, essayist, fiction writer, and songwriter. There was truly very little that Tagore touched that he did not succeed in. The richness, fullness, and simplicity, the sweetness that all Bengalis value in their culture and language nowadays, most will attest stems from the works of Tagore himself. There are relics, breaths of Rabindranath Tagore everywhere you go in Bangladesh. Framed and flowered photos of him in every common person's living room, songs of his on every single radio. The country does its best not to forget the legacy of this man. Rabindranath was a polymath. I don't understand fully what that word means, but to my understanding, after a quick Google, it means that he was basically an expert in many, many, many different things. Robin Zernot's most striking quality is what a personal and political man he was. How his art crossed and similarly made comment on national boundaries, but how his work also brought the common Bengali man back to himself. Common themes in his poetry, of which he wrote more than 7,000, were of art, nature, and love. Life and nature were his muses and themes that he explored deeply in his work. He was connected to the landscape and geography of Bengal, formerly Bengal, now known as India and Bangladesh. Besides his writing, Rabindranath had a deep commitment to literature and its relationship to education. As someone who did not thrive in a standardized educational system growing up, he found it to be tedious and without creativity, Tagore went on to build on a school, titled Shantiniketan, which means peace abode, where he would engage with students in the most creative ways possible. Classes were outside, and music and literature were just as important as other taught subjects. For the next little bit, I took it upon myself to interview the man who taught me the most about Bengali literature, the man I know to be the most passionate about Tagore, my own father. My household is one of the common households that has his face on its walls. His words were sung by my father every Saturday morning, waking me up from my sleep. My mother's trained in singing his songs, which is an entire discipline on its own. His music comes on, and my entire family, which is otherwise really rambunctious, becomes quiet to listen to him.
All-rounder genius. Rabindranath, সবচেয়ে বড় পরিচয় রবীন্দ্রনাথ, he is a poet. এবং poetry সঙ্গে সঙ্গে রবীন্দ্রনাথ এর জনপ্রিয়তা মূলত তার সঙ্গীতের জন্য, তার গান. He is more familiar to Bengali community for his songs. It is a unique. Something unique.
What do you think makes his songs unique?
The songs is unique for his tune, for sure. There is an amount of voice to sure. More importantly, hotche wording, bani. Sure, je shabdogulo, shabdo chayan. Ei shabdo chayan ta hotche Rabindranather ek ononno prathibhar nidorshon. Ami thik, I don't know how to explain it. You can feel it. Sahitya, in literature, feeling is the most important thing. And people like me, it is very tough for us to explain what is it. Rabindranath nijeo jatheshto tar gaan somporke jatheshto poribane optimistic chilen. Tini bishwas korten kaler koral mane somoye joto jabe, as time passed, he may be fade out. But his song will be boundary of time and space, and everything will be conquered by this, his songs. He believed it in his deep in his heart. Among eta satti Rabindranather sobcheye boro mane popularity mule hocche tar sangeet, tar gaan. Ekta gaan to sampurno hoy kokhon tar bani, tar tuning, tar wordings, and tar rhythms. And সবগুলি মিলিয়ে একটি গান পরিপূর্ণতা পায়, সেই পরিপূর্ণতাটা রবীন্দ্র সঙ্গীতে এত প্রবল ভাবে আছে যে আর ইদানিং কালেও আমি আর কোথাও খুঁজে পাই না। এবং এটা রবীন্দ্রনাথের যারা আছেন পশ্চিমবঙ্গের বিশিষ্ট যে যারা আছেন কম্পোজার আছেন, এটা একটা ইউনিক সৃষ্টি রবীন্দ্র।
So in 1912, Rabindranath came to Britain in 1912. A poet named W.B. Yeats, who's a very famous poet.
W.B. Yeats.
And when he met him, the Irish poet, he said that he'd never read anything like Rabindranath's poetry before, that something like that poetry had never been introduced to the West before. So he ended up having a really big influence in England, in the Western world, because people hadn't really read poetry or listened to music like the kind that he had produced. Yeah, so that was very important.
পরবর্তীকালে বোধহয় কবি ইয়েটস, যার জন্য তিনি নোবেল প্রাইজ পেয়েছিলেন, গীতাঞ্জলির ইয়েটা ইন্ট্রোডাকশনটা লিখে দিয়েছিলেন।
And so he was introduced to him in 1912, and then in 1913, I think Rabindranath went on to win the first Nobel Prize in Literature, and he was the first non-European man to win it.
Yeah.
That's a huge win for Bangladesh, for the East, for India.
Yeah, not only for Bangladesh, it is for in subcontinent. Most probably, he was the first man who win Nobel Prize from this subcontinent.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what he did with that Nobel Prize money?
Spend it for his Shantiniketan, for his ashram.
For his university, for his school.
Yeah, university, which is called Vishwabharati.
What an amazing man.
Amazing. Actually, এই মানুষটা সম্পর্কে এর জন্য অত্যন্ত শ্রদ্ধা আছে। ওনাদের বৌদি ছিলেন একজন, ওনার নাম ছিল কাদম্বরী দেবী এবং হি ওয়াজ ইনফ্লুয়েন্সড, হি অত্যন্ত সুরসিকা মহিলা ছিলেন। কাব্য সাহিত্য এগুলো তো ফিলিংস না থাকলে, তোমার রাঙা ফিলিংস না থাকলে এগুলোকে বোঝা যায় না, এটা স্বাভাবিক, সব মানুষের মধ্যে এটা থাকে না। ইউ হ্যাভ দি ডেপথ, তোমার সেই ডেপথ থাকতে হবে, না হলে তুমি সেটা বুঝতে পারবে না। কাদম্বরী দেবীর মধ্যে এটা ছিল এবং তিনি কবিতা বুঝতেন, সাহিত্য বুঝতেন, লিটারেচার বুঝতেন এবং রবীন্দ্রনাথকে তিনি বিশেষ ভীষণভাবে প্রভাবান্বিত করেছিলেন। অত্যন্ত কড়া সমালোচনা, ক্রিটিক ছিলেন তিনি রবীন্দ্রনাথ। হ্যাঁ, এবং পরবর্তীকালে রবীন্দ্রনাথের বিয়ের পরপরই মহিলা সুইসাইড করেন। অনেকেই রবীন্দ্রনাথের সঙ্গে তার সম্পর্ককে এটাকে বলেন যে একটু অন্য ধরনের, আমি এতে আমার কোনো এই সম্পর্কে কোনো ইন্টারেস্ট নাই, তাদের সম্পর্কটা কি ছিল, সেটা খারাপ ছিল না ভালো ছিল এটা ছিল না। তবে তার একটা ভালো দিকই হচ্ছে যে রবীন্দ্রনাথকে তিনি উদ্বুদ্ধ করতে পেরেছিলেন রবীন্দ্রনাথ হতে, আজকের রবীন্দ্রনাথের জন্য হওয়ার যে চেষ্টাটা রবীন্দ্রনাথের মধ্যে ছিল, এতে তিনি ইন্ধন যুগিয়েছিলেন, তিনি স্পিরিটটাকে স্পিরিটটা দিয়েছিলেন।
Yeah, I read about her. She was a very important influence on him from a very young age. And one of the people, when he would write and he would write all of his prose and his lyrics, he would go to her and she would offer him criticism in a way that no one else did. Very interesting. I didn't know about her because you hear about Rabindranath, obviously, growing up. I grew up with you saying his name all the time. But I had no idea about her. So one thing I wanted to talk about is I went to Bangladesh, obviously, last year with you, and I got a translated book from a brother of Rabindranath's poetry, Gitanjali, one of his most famous ones that we know. And I remember I was trying to read it, and you said, Baba, it's a good thing that you're reading it. It's good, but in English, it will never be the same. Hegemon Banglai, the way that it is in Bengali, it will never, ever be the same. Can you say more about that?
যে কোন কবিতাটা কিন্তু আর ভাষান্তরিত ট্রান্সলেট করা হলে তার অরিজিনালিটি, অরিজিনাল টেস্ট ফিল করা যায় না।
Especially because, তুমি বল, you said that his poetry is very like, he has very romantic poetry. He writes a lot about like the weather, the climate. Very poetic writing that when you put it in English, it just doesn't sound
good. তার কবিতার মূল কথাই, কবিতার মূল বিষয়বস্তু হচ্ছে প্রকৃতি, মানবপ্রেম এন্ড সৌন্দর্য, নেচার, লাভ এন্ড বিউটি, বিউটি অফ নেচার, বেসিক থিংস ইন হিজ পোয়েট্রি।
এন্ড সো সিম্পল বাট দে আর টাইমলেস, মানে দেল নেভার
always be true, what he says. এবং সবচেয়ে বড় জিনিস হচ্ছে যে রবীন্দ্রনাথ নাকি একবার নিউ ইয়র্ক টাইমস এর সঙ্গে সাক্ষাৎকারে বলেছিলেন একটা প্রশ্নের জবাবে, যে আপনার সবচেয়ে বড় গুণ কি এবং আপনার সবচেয়ে বড় দোষ কি। রবীন্দ্রনাথ বলেছিলেন, ইনকনসিস্টেন্সি, আমার চরিত্রের বড় গুণ ইনকনসিস্টেন্সি, আর আমার চরিত্রের বড় দোষ ইনকনসিস্টেন্সি। কেন, হাউ ইউ এক্সপ্লেইন ইট, যে এই ইনকনসিস্টেন্সির জন্য আমি অনেক সময় অনেক শব্দকে, সঠিক শব্দ প্রয়োগকে বাদ দিয়ে দিই, আমার মনে হয় এটা ঠিক হলো না, আবার অনেক ক্ষেত্রে আমি ওই শব্দটাকে বদলে দিয়ে একটা সুন্দর শব্দ প্রয়োগ করতে পারি, এতে আমার কাব্যের গুণটা আরো বেড়ে যায়। এটা কোয়ালিটিজ, শব্দ কাব্যের ক্ষেত্রে, কবিতার ক্ষেত্রে তোমার appropriate word is a very important thing. The also meaning noy, not is his dictionary meaning. It is beyond his meaning. It is a feeling, beyond its meaning.
So Rabindra Sangeet, for those who obviously don't understand Bengali, means Rabindra, which is his first name, and Sangeet means song. So this is a specific type of It's basically a specific type of singing almost. It's like people who become specifically trained in Rabindra Sangeet. He has his own genre almost, right?
Nowadays it is kitu the arrangement kitu change aste kitu kitu shilpi korte. The jemon aje Rabindra Sangeet muloto shudhu harmonium or tabla diye hoto. Idanin kale western ye ki bole western je guru বাদ্যযন্ত্র আছে, এগুলোর ইউজ হচ্ছে।
Do you like that? What do you think about that?
আমার কাছে personally I don't like that. অনেক ক্ষেত্রে আমার personal.
So traditionally you just want a harmonica and arki, tabla?
Tabla, harmonium and tabla.
Rabindra Sangeeta jono mane unit specific vocal train, like what makes it so different? Do you think everyone can sing Rabindra Sangeeta or only specific people?
It just looks like very easy. People start singing in our country, they are start with Rabindra Sangeet, but it is not easy. Being a Rabindra Sangeet Shilpi, Shartok Rabindra Sangeet Shilpi, hote hole, tumar classical, you have to train in classical, Indian classical music.
So it's not for everybody, not an easy thing.
Not for everybody, yeah. Gaan to sabai gaate.
So, Baba, can you tell me about one of your favorite Rabindra Sangeet? One of your favorite Rabindranath songs. I know it's hard for you to pick one, but pick maybe the most popular or the one that you find yourself singing the most.
Love song er ekta ami bolte pari amar eta bishon popular eta ottonto popular amar o porano jaha chai tumi tai ko what my heart says you are that.
I want to ask you another question about a song that when I was growing up, I heard this song a lot. It's a very famous song. Jodi tor dak shune kiu na ase, tobe ekla chore. Can you tell me the translation of that?
If anybody don't listen to you, try to do it alone.
Can you remember why he wrote that song? Do you know why he wrote it?
Ami thik eta jani na.
So I read around a bit, and apparently, I don't know how, I think this is true, that people say it to be true, historians, that he wrote it as a response to the British Raj, as a response to British colonization. Because India, Bengal wanted liberation, wanted freedom, obviously, from the British.
Yeah.
So he wrote Ekla Solore, which means if you call and someone doesn't hear your call, walk anyways.
Yeah, walk yourself. Yeah,
you walk by yourself. So
yeah.
It's a lot of people say that he wrote that about India or you know South Asia as a baby state and usurp colonizers trying to liberate themselves from India. That's what a lot of people say he wrote that song for.
Yeah, Rabindranath, he was bishon bhabe deshopremik ebong tar ei kotha gulo ei onek gaan gulo te tumi jano je Rabindranath je Bangladesher je এটা লিখেছিলেন in 1905 the British government divided Bengal into two parts. Against this decision there was a huge agitation in Bengal, in both of Bengal, and Rabindranath actively became the political person on that and he wrote these songs on that time.
And he didn't want it to be divided. And so he wrote Amar Shonar Bangla at that time?
Yeah.
Because why did they want to divide Bengal? Do you remember? Do you know?
Yeah, control. Their policy was divide and rule.
Yeah.
British main policy was divide and rule. It will be easy. If Bengal is inundated, then you know the terrorism act by the Subhash Chandra Bose and other things, the terrorist movement at that time was very strong in Bengal. So they think if we divided it, they will be weak, and it will be not possible for them to agitate everything. For that interest, they divided Bengal.
And then Rabindranath came out with that song, which later went on to become Bangladesh's national anthem.
It was a very popular song in Bengal, in Bangladesh. It was very popular at that time.
Bengal would later go on to become Bangladesh?
Yeah, one part.
Mm-hmm.
The British divided it and they named it Bangla and Pashchim Bangla. And then it is go to the Pakistan, and its name was Purbo Pakistan, East Pakistan. And after that liberation, it became Bangladesh.
So language is obviously very, very, I mean, language is important to any culture, but
yeah.
Language plays a very unique role in Bangladesh, and that's why Rabindranath is so important. That's why Rabindranath is timeless, right? He represents Bengali language in a way that many people call him the father of Bengali language. He's mastered
it.
He made it his own. He changed it.
Very important. The whole Bengali culture is centered
around this person?
Yeah, on Rabindranath.
Can you imagine that, Baba, being one person with so much
being
influence?
Yeah, you wrote down three countries.
India, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh, right?
Bangladesh.
I think a lot of people don't know that he wrote India's national anthem. A lot of people don't know that. But he was very, very worldly, you know? Like, he loved the East. He loved India. He loved Bangladesh. He was so involved in those politics.
Yeah.
But he also came to England, right? And he also met with famous poets and politicians and thinkers in the West as well.
Maybe 12 times he go for travel.
Yeah, and in those times, that's crazy. In that time, Bangladesh, to be able to travel like that, that is formidable.
And 1912, met with the poet, English poet Yeats.
He won the Nobel Peace Prize the next year.
In 1925, he wants to go Peru, but he fell sick and take the journey break in Argentina. Yeah, at that time he was 61 years old, and met with an Argentinian poet, Victor Ocampo.
He influenced so many poets all over the world, so many politicians, so many activists.
And he is influenced from his time. There was too many poets, but everybody was under his belt, and that is, they have no, in art, what is the main thing in the art, whatever, you being a poet, being a singer, what is key point of this? You have to have your own characteristics, you have own style. Rabindranath has had this, and he was influenced every poet of that time.
Thank you so much for tuning in with me. The introduction to this segment was taken from Satyajit Ray's documentary on Rabindranath Tagore, an incredible watch. You can find it on YouTube. I highly recommend. And the last song there was my father's noted favorite, Ekla Cholo Re, sang by Suchita Mitra, an incredible singer who sang many of Rabindranath's songs very, very well.
Are you energetic, mature, and committed to making a difference in the life of an Indigenous youth? Then you'd make a great mentor. Volunteer mentors at Vancouver's Urban Native Youth Association help youth recognize their many strengths and words towards future goals. To learn more about how you can become a mentor to a deserving young person, please visit unya.bc.ca/mentorship.
Welcome back to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR 101.9 FM, made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. My name is Aiza, and I'm your host. You just heard a piece produced by Shali Chaudhry about her and her father's shared love of the poet laureate Rabindranath Tagore. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this week's Motherlands theme is conversations. When it comes to conversations about Asianness, we also have to examine and discuss the realities of living in Canada as Asian diaspora. Our next piece of the hour is an interview I did with UBC Professor Ben Chung. Ben is teaching a new course at UBC about Asian health and migration. Let's take a listen. Hi there, my name is Isa Yu. I'm a student at UBC and recently discovered a new class that interested me when I got in contact with the people at the Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies program. They told me that there was going to be a class that touches on the questions such as access and barriers to health services, and how culture and race intersect with individual and community well-being. After listening to the Speak My Language podcast coordinated by CITR member Rachel Lau, I found myself more curious about the subject. At the time of the recording, the only info I could find about this course was its course code. But I really wanted to know more, so I reached out to the professor who teaches the course, Professor Ben Chung. Ben is a lecturer in the Department of Psychology at UBC. He's also an affiliated faculty member in the Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Program. I started out by asking Ben to describe the course and what it entails.
Yeah, for sure. So the course is going to be generally about health amongst Asian diaspora in Canada. And it's meant to be a very, very general sort of survey course about health, various topics associated with health within the Asian diaspora community in Canada. And we're talking about things like policing and the impact of policing on community health, as well as different ways of looking at traditional medicine, depending on the different types of traditional Asian medicine that we that we'll be able to sort of access information about. And this really came about as a result of some conversations that ACAM was having a while ago in trying to support a lot of Asian students' concerns about mental health, whether it's sort of as a function of racism that they might experience, or just not being able to access the appropriate forms of mental health care because there's a lack of sufficient culturally sensitive mental health services. So it was really coming out of that kind of conversation, thinking about how to best support Asian students, you know, racialized students in general, but specifically Asian students.
I'm also a bit curious about the stresses that accompany, like, immigration and the diasporic experience.
Immigration can be extremely stressful, right? Because you don't understand the healthcare system. You don't understand the government system. You might not even understand the educational system, and that's where some a lot of immigrant children have difficulties as well, because, you know, their parents might have grown up in a very completely different educational system compared to the one, let's say, here if they're immigrating to Canada. And so the parents aren't actually able to give them the same kinds of cultural knowledge that is applicable in this particular cultural setting. And so you often see clashes between these different generations. So you get this, what we call acculturative gap. There's this difference in the cultural outlook and the cultural understanding of the system. And to compound all of that might be numerous instances of racism that they might experience, of discrimination that they might experience. Right? So there's a lot of reasons why immigration can be in and of itself a very traumatic experience, a very difficult, mentally difficult experience.
Going back to your point about the parent and children relationships, I'm a bit curious if there are ways in which children of immigrants who might not be immigrants themselves might still inherit some of that trauma left over from immigration.
So there's a lot of different things to think about here. It could be, you know, the way that their parents raised them with a lot of, let's say, a lot of physical punishment that might be very difficult for immigrant kids, especially for immigrants to handle, because immigrant kids are being raised in a completely different environment in which the presiding cultural narrative is such that no amount of hitting is appropriate and any form of physical punishment is wrong, it's child abuse, and that can become a very difficult cultural experience for immigrant children. At the same time, you know, we parent the way that we were parented in many ways, right? Because that's our model for parenting. And so we might potentially, as immigrant children, we might end up perpetuating similar kinds of behaviors that our parents placed onto us, and then that might in turn pass on that kind of experience onto our own children. And so whatever, you know, mental difficulties we experience because of that confusion, that clash of cultural messages, we might end up passing that on to our children as well. And you can also imagine this being particularly difficult, especially difficult for people, for children who grew up realizing and discovering that they might be, for instance, genderqueer or gender or sort of non-conforming, with non-conforming gender identities. You can see how, you know, they're trying to find acceptance in communities or in this culture in North America that's supposed to be more accepting. At the same time, they also have to deal with potentially more conservative views from their immigrant parents, immigrant families, and that in and of itself is also creating trauma. And certainly that kind of interaction can also transfer to their kids as well. And it's hard to say what's definitively going to happen, right? Because every family is going to react to the same situation in very different ways. And presumably there are also some immigrant children who they'll figure that, you know, whatever they did to me was wrong. I'm not going to do to my children what they did to me. And so it's, like I said, it's difficult to predict, but certainly there we do run the risk because trauma can always be passed on.
Okay, well, thank you so much for letting me do this interview twice.
No problem, happy to.
All right, thanks again. Thank you for listening. This interview was conducted by me, Isa Yu, edited by Alex DeVore. The song you hear is Stately Shadows by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Ben Chung for his time and to the Community Radio Fund of Canada for making this piece possible.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam, Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam, Nisiyaya,
Anthas Yakuya, Talitin, Homasquim, Asteo. Welcome back. You're listening to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming on CITR 101.9 FM. Today's show has been made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. You just heard an interview I did with UBC psychology professor Ben Chung. Our last piece of the day is by Joshua Azizi. Joshua Azizi is a Vancouver-based journalist who recently graduated from UBC's Graduate School of Journalism. He has previously interned at the Globe and Mail, CBC Vancouver and Yukon News, and the Georgia Strait. He's interested in urban affairs, community issues, diversity, and popular culture. In honor of Asian Heritage Month, Josh has produced a very cute story. Have you ever wondered how your parents met? Josh might have grown up on the North Shore of Vancouver, but his father, Fod, had a very different childhood than he did. Born into 1960s Iran as a religious minority, Fahd left his home country when he was 14 years old to go to a boarding school in northern England, just as his home country was on the cusp of a revolution. In this piece, Josh sits down with his father to learn about his life and what it was like to move from Iran to England to Canada. And of course, he learns about how his father met his Canadian mother here in Canada. And while their connection wasn't immediate, it was lasting. This is a very funny and touching story. Let's take a listen.
All right, we are recording. So actually, just kind of to start out, can you tell our listeners just a bit about who you are?
I am basically a middle-aged man. I gotta think about that. That's a weird question to ask. Who I am, but put it on pause until I think. I'll let you know when I'm ready.
Fahd is my dad. He was born in Iran on December 18th, 1963, but now he lives on the North Shore of Vancouver. I asked if I could sit down with him to talk about his life. On family road trips when I was young, he would talk about his childhood, his teen years in England, and his nostalgia for the 80s. But there was a lot I didn't know, and there's probably a lot I still don't know.
My name is Fawad Azizi. I go by Frank, usually at work, because people have difficulty with the spelling of my name. And I am basically an Iranian in exile for the last 50 years, and I'm still considered Iranian, even though I barely remember the country now.
My dad lived in Tehran until he was 14 years old. His family was well off, but they didn't fit into the larger Iranian society.
Well, my family belonged to a religious minority. They were Baha'is, and historically, Baha'is were not very popular with the mainstream Iranians. So you tended to bond mostly with your cousins and your relatives, and you didn't venture out into the mainstream society that much. There was always a level of fearfulness, you know. It was common for us to get threatened at school. It was common for us to lose friends when they found out that you were a Baha'i. So it was like you had two lives, your Baha'i life and your life outside, and you had your friends who were Baha'is and you had your friends who were not, and often the two of them didn't mix.
In the late 1970s, Iran was filled with rising tensions, and my dad was just a kid. Iran's emperor, the Shah, was becoming wildly unpopular. Inequality was rampant. The country was westernizing, but people didn't want that. The Shah was overthrown in the 1979 revolution, which saw Ayatollah Khomeini come to power and establish an Islamic Republic. By then, my dad and his family had left the country.
My family left Iran, again, because they were Baha'is and they felt the danger of staying in the country after the Iranian Revolution. But the reason I left Iran was because I was sent to a boarding school in the UK. And I never made it back home. I left June of 1978. I was expected to come back in December. Of course, the revolution started around November of 1978, and my parents came to visit me in December, and that's when they decided just to stay in the UK and make the move.
The new government reignited hatred towards Baha'is and pledged to persecute them. Many were attacked or arrested. Over 200 were killed, according to Amnesty International. But thankfully, my dad and grandparents remained in the UK.
Living in a boarding school with a bunch of British kids, it was challenging, you know. First of all, it was lonely. Second of all, you felt very far away with no communication with your parents. And I was quite young. I was only 14 years old. And everything they did was strange to me. And sometimes just didn't make sense. The food was horrible. Just disastrous. And the weather was extremely cold. My school was in north of England, so it's usually in the winters was easily 10 to 15 degrees below zero, and we never had adequate clothing, and most of my friends at that time were actually the other foreign students in the school, because the English students, they didn't mix well with us at that time. But there was some level of acceptance by the English kids, and I didn't feel too much prejudice every now and then, but it wasn't something I was dealing with daily, let's put it that way.
My dad arrived in Canada in 1983, when he was 19 years old. His family decided to make the move because they thought they would be more accepted here. He says becoming a Canadian was much easier than becoming an Englishman.
Well, there was a bit of a culture shock when I came to Canada. Things were different, you know. People listened to rock and roll. Here I was coming from the UK, where you listen to pop and new wave music, and people dressed differently from how we dressed in the UK, and people also acted differently. But there wasn't what I call a difficult time for me when I came here. I blended in pretty easily. I found Canadians very friendly. I didn't have to deal with prejudices of the English society. You know, even though I actually loved living in England, and you know, I got very used to my life there. But in the long run, I knew the English people would always look at me as an Iranian. Strangely enough, you know, in Canada, you know, I've been out of Iran for 45 years. And I still have an accent. But there are very few people who actually ask me where I come from. It actually surprises me how few people ask me that question, which shows how open-minded the Canadian people are towards accepting people from different cultures.
While in Vancouver, he entered business school at UBC. Unlike in England, his social life blossomed in Canada. Eventually, he became friends with someone named Jenny, and he took an interest in a roommate.
I first met your mother in a friend of mine's apartment. She was her roommate. And I used to see her pictures on the wall. I never actually saw her for a long time because she was never home. And I was always wondering who this person was. It was to me, she was striking. Right away, I was very interested in meeting her. She looked totally different from anyone else I'd ever met.
So, I guess actually just kind of to start, would you be able to tell our listeners a little bit about who you are?
My name's Jennifer, and I am... What do I say about myself, Josh? You got to start again.
You can say anything.
I am a... what am I? I'm a middle-aged woman. I don't know. Start again.
Jennifer is my mother. She was born in Winnipeg on May 31st, 1964, but she moved to West Vancouver when she was 5.
Well, I don't want to call myself a business person because I'm not. I am a dog mom, and I am a mother of two young men in their 20s, and I don't know, I'm just a resident of West Van. That's it.
My parents met in my mother's apartment when she was in grad school.
I was at UBC, and I was in my apartment, and I was working on my master's and in history, and I had a lot of books surrounding me at my dining room table, and my friend was friends with him, and she brought him home one afternoon, and he walked into the apartment, and I could hear he had heeled shoes, and they were walking quite loudly down my hallway. And I could smell the cologne from the door. And I looked up when he came in the living room, and I thought, what is that? Who is that? And he walked right up to me, put his hands on either side of the table, and leaned over and said, what are you doing? And I was shocked that he would come into my personal space like that. But I was also impressed that he did it too.
When I asked my mom if she could be part of this piece, she warned me that the reasons she took interest in my dad were a bit shallow.
I thought he was very attractive, confident. He reminded me of someone who was European. His accent sounded French, and I thought he looked like a mover.
A bit of clarification here. My dad was a serial dater in his 20s. What do you mean by a mover?
He had a lot of girlfriends, and I wasn't going to have anything to do with him.
Why were you afraid to have anything to do with him?
Well, I didn't want to... Well, I didn't want to be another casualty.
Okay, I see.
Okay, that's it.
My mom says that my dad was different from most Canadians. But it wasn't necessarily because he was from Iran.
Yeah, he looked different. He dressed a little bit more... the only way I could describe it is European looking. He wasn't a very West Coast looking person. And he wore more colors, which I actually didn't really like. He was very striking in his appearance, and very considerate when he talked, and seemed like he was listening, and he had a different sort of persona.
My parents met in 1991 and got married 2 years later. Mixed-race relationships weren't too common at the time. According to StatsCan, only 2.6% of all marriages or common-law relationships in 1991 were mixed unions. But neither of my parents gave this much thought.
I don't think of him as another race anyway. It seems funny when I say that. So, that's it.
But yeah, what did other people kind of think?
Well, I think they probably thought it was different. Yeah.
How so?
Because he was different. I didn't see him as different, but I think other people probably did. I remember one of my friends bringing up a book or a movie or something about a woman who had married a Persian guy, and he took the the baby and they left the country back to Iran, and she was quite concerned about this possibility. And I'd never heard of it, honestly. So anyway.
When I asked my dad if there was anything that stuck out to him about coming from an Iranian family and marrying into a white European family, he told me I had the wrong guy for the question.
You're talking to somebody who left his country when he was 14 years old. By the time I was 15, I hadn't spoken Persian for 6 months. I could barely speak it. You just forget if you don't speak a language. It actually becomes hard to speak it. So for me, all I knew was Western girls. I didn't know too many Persian girls. I didn't see them as differently from me. I didn't see them as a novelty. It was the other way around, you know. Persian girls were a novelty to me.
Fortunately, neither of their parents had an issue with their relationship.
My dad liked him a lot. He thought he was very well-mannered and like a gentleman. And my sister said that he thought he was like a prince. I guess nobody said anything negative that I know of. If there was any concern, it would have been behind the scenes. I guess they respected me enough not to say anything, but I don't know of any negative impressions of him. He gives a good impression.
Of course, my parents would have preferred a Baha'i girl. It just didn't happen that way. You know, it was more important for them that I marry somebody who was a Baha'i for understandable reasons than actually a Persian. It is a lot easier to marry into your own culture. There are challenges when you marry into another culture all the time. And it is not sometimes easy, but for me, that's all I knew. So eventually, my parents got used to the fact that I probably was not going to marry a Persian girl. And somehow they really liked Jennifer. I was actually surprised when my father encouraged me to ask her to marry me. He basically gave me the green light to go ahead. I can't take all the credit. I did not have to fight for it. So I'm sorry I can't come up with a story that here I was a rebel and a fighter. No, I wasn't. My parents took Jennifer in quite willingly. It went pretty smoothly. I didn't have any problems at all. Maybe a couple of phone calls from my aunts and uncles asking me whether I knew what I was doing and if I was sure I was doing the right thing. But that was the extent of it. I am sure my grandfather was pretty disappointed. But besides that, no, we didn't really have any issues. Of Iranians or Persians that left Iran and ended up here. I mean, of course, there were some Iranians who landed here maybe a year or two before me, but when we got here, there weren't too many Iranians here, and people didn't really know what we were about. In North America, North Americans had very, very little experience with Middle Eastern people. It wasn't such in the UK. You know, there were many Persians who lived many, many years. You know, going back, you know, if I, you know, you can go back to the 1800s where there were Persians living in Europe and in the UK, you know, and Iranian men were often sent to Europe for education. So the British had, they were used to Iranians. They knew what they were about, but the Canadians were not. So I wouldn't say there was a prejudice against us at the time, but you know, I noticed, especially when I graduated from university and I was trying to find a job, it wasn't easy for us. I don't think we were given the same opportunities as the Canadian graduates were given. Again, not because there was a prejudice against us. It was, I think we were an unknown factor. People didn't know what we were. And this has changed right now. I don't think what you look like or what your family background is matters that much these days when you go for a job interview. You know, if you can do the work, you're given the job. It wasn't so in 1983 or 1984 or 1985 for that matter. We've come a long way. We should be proud of it, you know.
The next morning, my dad told me he wanted to redo his introduction. He spent some time thinking about it, and he wrote down a different answer. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are?
I am a 56-year-old Jewish-blooded Iranian Baha'i businessman. Raised and educated in the UK and Canada.
All right.
This is Motherlands on CITR 101.9 FM, an Asian Heritage Month special programming initiative. I'm your host, Isa. You just heard a piece made by Joshua Azizi about how his mom and dad met. I hope you enjoyed it. Before I sign off, it's time for this week's content recommendation. Black Panther is a Chinese band that was really popular in the 90s, and my favorite song is Don't Break My Heart. Sunset Roller Coaster is a band that makes groovy city pop-esque music that is great to dance to as well as cry to. Give them a listen. So thank you very much for listening to Motherlands on CITR 101.9 FM. Again, this week's theme was Conversations. I'm your host, Isa, and today's other producers were Shali Chaudhry and Joshua Azizi. The music you heard throughout today's show is from Blue Dot Sessions. As always, Motherlands is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. If you missed any of today's program, no worries. You can find today's episodes and every episode on CITR's website at citr.ca. Just search Motherlands in the search bar. You can also find this show in podcast form on iTunes. Tune in at the same time next Tuesday, May 26th at 3 p.m. for episode 4 of Motherlands. Next week is our last episode, and the theme is What Comes Next. I'm your host, Isa, signing off. Thanks for listening. Talk to you soon.